Hi, everyone. I think we're going to get started. I'm going to start out by saying, can people hear me if I don't use the mic?
Yeah.
Is that good enough? Okay, I'm going to try without the mic. If at any point anyone can't, if there's any speaker that people can't hear, we want to make sure that everyone is able to fully hear. If people could just raise their hands if they can't hear, then we'll use the mic. So I think everyone will just decide whether or not to use it. So welcome. Thank you all for coming. It's a fantastic turnout, so I'm really glad to see the interest on this issue. My name is Sarah Norman, and I'm an attorney with the Prison Law Office, where we litigate prison conditions in California. And I'm really thrilled to be here with such a fantastic panel on this important issue. So each of the panelists will be speaking for a little while, and then we'll take questions at the end. So I think we're going to have plenty of time to have a lot of engagement and discussion on these issues, so please save your questions, and we will hopefully be able to get to all of them after everyone's had a chance to speak. So I just wanted to very briefly set the scene by noting that this is kind of a bittersweet moment right now in the movement against supermaxes and isolation units in prison, because 2 weeks ago, the Madrid versus Kate lawsuit in California was dismissed as being complete. And so for those of you who don't know the Madrid case, it was one of the first big cases in the 90s to attack the supermaxes, these prisons that were built to confine people in isolation, to deprive them, sensory deprivation units, to really deprive them of human contact. And our lawsuit against the Pelican Bay prison is called Madrid. And in 1995, we won that case. And the federal judge, issued a sweeping order requiring extensive reforms in the supermax prison up at Pelican Bay. So he required changes to the kind of horrors that are incidental to this sort of planned sensory deprivation, planned torture. So we required tremendous number of changes in terms of who can go in, excluding people with mental illness and developmental disabilities, the most vulnerable population. Reforming the ways in which force was investigated and charged with all the brutality that's usually incidental to these kinds of units. But sadly, and sort of horribly, the judge in that case did not shut down the whole prison and say that this whole way of doing things, of locking people up under these incredibly depraved circumstances, really, he did not say that that was unconstitutional. And that was the big failing. And if this judge, the judge's name is Felton Henderson, and he's a civil rights giant. He's an extraordinary, brave, incredible judge. And if he couldn't go that far because the law is not there, it couldn't be done. So the failing of the Madrid case is that it didn't stop this practice. And if Felton Henderson didn't do it, nobody was going to be able to. So that shows the limitations of the court system as a way of addressing the kind of abuses that we're all going to be talking about, and you probably are all already somewhat familiar with. So the court system can stop or prevent some of the worst harms, but it can't shut these places down. And that's what we all have to do. That's what we all have to work on as a movement and as an informed populace to make our government stop doing these things in our name. So on that front, I just wanted to say there's occasional bits of good news. So let me give you that before everybody else depresses you horribly. The New Mexico legislature recently called for a study on solitary confinement practices. That's something. And bills have been introduced in Texas and in Colorado that would significantly limit the use of solitary confinement. There's no movement in California on this front right now. But for what it's worth, these prisons, these units are incredibly expensive. So if people don't care about human rights, they care about their pocketbook. So that's potential opening for future action in this area. So with that, I want to turn it over to our first speaker, who is Eddie Zhang, who immigrated to Oakland from China at a young age and was arrested and charged as an adult with robbery as a teenager, sentenced to a life term in prison. While in prison, he was one of those extraordinary people who was able to rise above the brutality in which he was living, earned his GED and a college degree, and actually got a date, got released, which is kind of incredible. It takes incredible strength of character and achievement. So it's really an honor to be with him on this panel. He's written and published articles on his experience as an Asian American inmate, the importance of ethnic studies, and on Buddhism. And with that, I will turn it over to Eddie.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, everybody, for your presence. You know, it's truly an honor for me to be able to have an opportunity to share my experience with all of you, and then at the same time to learn from different experts and in the community about the impact incarceration isolation has on the whole population. So for me, you know, when you look at me, you wouldn't see someone that who have been in prison. I would be considered probably what you fit into as a model minority. You look at me, I could be anyone besides an ex-con. So, but the reality is, there are many of us that live in the community who have made bad choices when we were younger, and then who has turned their life around. So for me, I'm very proud of myself for being able to make that transformation while I was incarcerated, and then to come out here trying to provide services for the community and for the youth. So what I do is I'm a community advocate, prison advocate. Also, I work in the Community Youth Center of San Francisco as a project manager. I'm also part of the collaboration effort in the city of San Francisco with the Community Response Network. So we do violence prevention and we respond to a lot of crises that's happening in the community. My experience being incarcerated was the fact that when I committed my crime of robbery and kidnapping, I was charged as an adult and sentenced to life with possibility of parole, which is 7 years to life. So I ended up spending 19 years of my life inside prison, and after I was able to get my release from the parole board and the governor, then I was detained immediately by the Department of Homeland Security for deportation. Because in 1996, they passed the anti-immigration reform law after the 1996 Oklahoma City bombing by Timothy McVeigh. They passed this immigration law that states that anyone that who is not a citizen of the United States, who has committed a crime of aggravated felony or crime of moral turpitude, that you're automatically detained and deported. So I fell into that category, so therefore I was detained and ordered deported. I fought my case for 2 years and I lost my case, therefore I'm ordered deported back to China. So during my incarceration, I wanted to focus on the times that I was in solitary confinement for 11 months. I was participating in a college program and we wanted to learn more about the Asian American literatures and then Asian American histories. We wanted to promote that so other people would learn about that culture and that issue so we can promote racial harmony. Because in the college program, we always learn about the American history, the African American, Europeans, Latino history, but no one is learning about the API history. Right? So therefore, myself and a few other prisoners, we started to advocating for those type of courses in the college program. But when we started to having dialogues in the community in prison, then the administration got a hold of all the documents, the proposal that we signed and written, requesting for those type of programs. Then they put all of us in solitary confinement. So we have five people who signed the proposal. One is an African American, one is a Jewish American, one was Filipino American, the other one is Vietnamese American, and myself, the Chinese. So out of five people, they put the Chinese in the solitary confinement, the Filipino American in the solitary confinement, and the Vietnamese American. So basically they say that we're trying to circumvent the system. They came up with some charges saying that we're trying to circumvent the system, and put us in solitary confinement under investigation. So they took all our paperwork, they took all the books that we were reading, any book that they deem is kind of like radical or militant, then they were investigating. The books like George Jackson, The Solidarity Brothers, Malcolm X books, any type of books that has anything to do with civil rights, kind of revolutionary, and different, the COINTELPRO, any type of those type of material, they confiscated. So normally when you're in a solitary confinement, normally you go in there, they give you the punishment, they write you up, they say you did A, B, and C, violating the rules and regulation of the prison system, then they'll lock you up for a specific amount of time. So in my incident, I spent 11 months inside. And the reason I spent so long inside solitary confinement because they were trying to, they found me guilty, but not for signing a proposal, but for me wanting to set up a website out in the community, having other people set up a website for me. So they say that I can do that. They say that I share my writings with other people on the streets. I ask people to take my writing out in the college program so I can share with people on the street. So because of that, they put me in solitary confinement. So the process of being in solitary confinement is like normally when they finish, whether it's 3 months in solitary confinement or 6 months or so, you go back out to the mainland population. So in my case, I was continued to be withheld inside the solitary confinement because of the fact that they couldn't get me, legally they couldn't get me to another prison because I was fighting them to put me back on the mainland population. Right? So they didn't want to do that because they considered me as a threat to the mainland population and the security of the institution. So the time that I spent in San Quentin solitary confinement is different than what you normally hear or read about in the Supermax, in the Pelican Bay or Corcoran or Folsom, those new prisons. And the reason why is because San Quentin does not have well-developed solitary confinement units. Right? They are, because historically it's very old, whereas the new prisons, they have steel doors, you know, they have bigger cells locked in there. In San Quentin, they are still have the bars. Right? So you have bars, they have the tray slot inside the cell, pretty much the cell just like any other cells, probably around 8 by 9 inches. You stay in there pretty much 23 hours a day. So when I went into solitary confinement, I was given a sheet, a blanket, and a Bible. That's all I received. You cannot you don't have any pen to write with. They give you a stem from the pen stem, so you can only write with that because they were afraid that you would use the other thing as a weapon. So when you're locked in there, pretty much you stay in there 23 hours a day. We get to shower about twice a week, and every time we go to shower, we have to be strip searched, and then put our hand through the bar where they feed us in the tray slot. And once they handcuff you, then you have to walk backwards, step out of the cell, and then they took us to a shower, which is made out of another cell, a single cell. Then they'll uncuff me, and then we get to shower. After they give us a razor to shower with, and the razor is the size of your kind of your finger, about this big. That's the razor. You have to use that to shave for the prisoners. And then they'll provide a soap and a toothpaste powder for you to brush your teeth. And when you finish, pretty much you're locked in the cell. And we do get exercise time about 3 times a week. That all depends on whether there's a lockdown in the institution or there's a fog line, because the San Quentin is located by the bay in Marin County. So a lot of times they have fog coming in. Whenever they have the fog rolling in, they'll shut down the whole prison. So it's your time to go get some air, go get some exercise, then you don't get to, it's fog line or there's a lockdown, then you don't get to go. So I have experience being inside my cell for a whole week without being outside for any fresh air. And the only human contact that I was able to receive was the time that when the officer put the handcuffs on my arm, and then when they held my arm to escort me to walk, that's the only human contact that I received. Because any time the visiting is behind glass, you have to go behind glass, and they have to set up appointments ahead of time. For me, at the beginning, it was very tough psychologically. It was very tough for me to deal with that because I didn't have anything in myself besides the Bible. And then, so for me, so I didn't know when I was going to get out of this solitary confinement. And then the other thing is, was very stressful was the fact that I was a life-term prisoner. So a life-term prisoner, whenever you get in trouble, pretty much the parole board can deny you for up to 5 years. Back in those times, back to 5 years for parole, deny your parole. Or nowadays, they can deny you up to 15 years if you go up for parole. Right? So for me, it's like I was worried about that because all the time that I had spent in prison, I was pretty much what they call a model prisoner. I never got in any trouble. I was obeying the rules and regulations and all of that. But because I signed a proposal, and then they say that I'm trying to challenge the authority, so they put me inside the confinement. That's the only time that I was inside the confinement. So it was a new experience for me. So it was the worst time for me for a long time inside it, because I cannot have the normal contacts with people, and then it's very loud inside an open bar situation when you're in a cell. So everybody who are locked up, my neighbors, the people, because the tiers, we have 5 tiers. So if you have 5 tiers of people, there's like 200-300 people inside the building. and they are close in. And then everybody is yelling, right, trying to communicate with other people just so they can have some human contact, like kind of voice recognition, knowing that somebody is there also. It's just not myself that I'm locked up in the cell. So people would talk to each other. They would rap. You know, they could make songs and they would scream. And there were a lot of mentally ill people who are on medications are in there that they could not handle what's going on inside the solitary confinement. So what they do is a lot of times they will pretend that they have some type of hallucination so they can just get the medication. Because once they get the medication, they can just sleep and just try to sleep their time away. Because normally, the people who are locked up in those units in San Quentin, they don't stay there long. When you have a SHU program for a year, they'll send you to Pelican Bay, Corcoran, or Folsom for the long-term solitary confinement. So that's why those are temporary. But for me, being there for so long, that I have to constantly deal with the ear deafening cacophony that's being perpetuated every day by the cage occupants, pretty much. And the guards, normally, if you get a good guard that who is, really cares, and then they are very nice to you, they try to talk to you, they try to give you some help or whatever they can. But if you run into some of the guards that just there to get paid and just to lock the door, then you're going to have even more trouble. Because when you ask them for help, they ignore you. So you see them, but then they're not humans, right? It's become like robots, and we will cage animals inside the cage. So when we're trying to reach out, there's no response. Nobody's reaching back in. So besides that, then definitely it's the length of incarceration, in there. From my experience, it's like 11 months for me was a long time. And fortunately for me, that I have tremendous community support, I have tremendous family support, that I was able to make my worst of time to become the best of time, just about the line from the Charles Dinkins in the Tale of Two Cities. So for me, I was able to overcome those challenges, to be able to come out of solitary confinement whole, without having to utilize medication to pass this time, and without utilizing any type of, self-destruction methods to pass my time in the solitary confinement. So I was able to come out as a person who appreciates more, even though in prison, than because solitary confinement is a prison within a prison. So, but I do want to save some time for the other panelists, because I can talk on and on about all this. But when we go to question and answer period, I'll talk more about not only about my experience, but experience of other people that and the impact it has on the community, on why the community should care about, why each and every one should care about that, right? Because it's a safety issue, it's a public health issue. So I would like to pass on to the next presenter.
Thank you. Thank you. So next, although I don't think any of us have enviable positions following you, Eddie, thank you for that. Next we have Keramit Ryder, who is a PhD candidate at Cal. She also has an MA in criminal justice and a JD. She's going to have unbelievable numbers of degrees before she's done. But as an academic, she's taken her time and spent it extraordinarily well for all of us by studying prison conditions and particularly supermaxes. So she's made herself into an expert on the field, and she's currently researching sort of the supermax prison boom, the explosion in the 80s and 90s of these facilities. So she's here to enlighten us on the history.
Or depress you with the history, as the case may be. So I think Eddie really gave us a really strong sense of what these facilities are like, and knowing what they're like gave me the motivation to want to understand where they came from and why policymakers ever thought this was a good idea. So I thought I'd just give us a little background about how I think people have heard of Guantanamo and communications management units, but people often think of solitary confinement as something that happened in the past. You might read about it as something the Quakers did in the 1800s, and then we got sort of more civilized and we stopped doing that. And then all of a sudden in the 1980s, for whatever reason, states decided this was a really good idea again and started building facilities to keep people in long-term solitary confinement. So just to give you a little sense of the history, Arizona built the first supermax in 1986. So they were leading the way in bad criminal justice policy long before the immigration laws came about. And then after that, states started looking around. All the states in the 1980s were building prisons. There was a massive incarceration boom. The number of people in prison was increasing. The amount of funding going towards prisons was increasing. And so as part of that, states were trying to decide how to build the best prisons or the most efficient prisons. And California was, of course, one of the states doing this. And they started looking around to all the states. And they noticed that Arizona had this brand new facility. When I say they built a supermax, I mean they built the first prison that was designed specifically to keep people in solitary confinement for the long term. So for more than 30 days or a month or two, like Eddie was describing usually happens at San Quentin, these facilities were built to keep people in solitary confinement for years or more. That was the intention when they were opened. And the idea was they were built in the 80s with really modern technology. They were computerized, so someone could sit in a central room and press a button and it would open a door and allow someone to walk out to their shower once or twice a week. And no one would ever have to have any human contact at all. There wouldn't be these cells with these bars so that people could yell between them, or officers would have to sometimes interact with the prisoners. So that was the concept. And Arizona did this, and then California copied their model and built Pelican Bay in 1989. And after that, the idea sort of took off around the country. In 1994, the federal prison system opened the administrative maximum in Florence, Colorado. And almost every state built some kind of facility that kept people in these kinds of conditions after that. And one of the things that's really important about this story, I think, is that it happened, especially in Arizona and California, where these first facilities were built, happened without any kind of public oversight or legislative attention at all. So the legislature in California said, we're going to build a lot of prisons. Here's a lot of money. They did it through, sometimes the voters approved the ballot propositions that gave the money and the bonds to the Department of Corrections, but then the Department of Corrections had virtual free rein in what kinds of prisons they built. So when the Supermax was built in California, it was architects and correctional administrators designing a new kind of prison and collaborating. And when people first started hearing about it was once prisoners got sent there. And they started filing claims about the unconstitutional conditions, and people like lawyers from the prison law office started going up to visit to figure out what was going on. But it had happened without any kind of public oversight. And so I think it's a really important piece of this story that the legislators and the people were sort of missing in this correctional innovation. I think sometimes we think of punishment as something that's driven by the people, but in this case, it's an extreme practice that was really driven internally without the right kind of oversight. And I think in part because of that, they've been incredibly hard to challenge, because they were already built. These incredibly expensive structures were already in place by the time people started to realize what had happened and started to challenge them. And I think they were built very specifically to be clean and to have enough light and to be places where it might be a little harder to bring the kinds of lawsuits that people thought of prisons being brought against prisons in the 70s when they were filthy and people were being obviously abused. In these facilities, no one has ever touched even. So it's harder to say that there's been abuse, although there were horrible abuses in some of these prisons when they first opened. But now, as Sarah said, you know, the judge has looked at Pelican Bay and said, no one is being physically abused in this facility anymore, and so it becomes much harder to challenge these kinds of conditions and these places. And I think they were designed so that there wouldn't be any kind of human contact or sense that there was physical abuse happening. So I'm going to talk a little more later on about what it's like for people coming out of these facilities, but I'm going to leave it at that in terms of just giving you a sense of the history. And I think one of the main lessons to learn is just the importance of kind of educating yourself about what our prisons are like and being here at events like this and sort of making sure that we don't let these practices continue to happen without the kind of public oversight that there should be. So.
Thank you. All right, next we have Terry Coopers, Dr. Terry Coopers, who is a psychiatrist at the Wright Institute and has been an extraordinary expert in many, many, many prison reform cases around the country, and is really a leader in the field of being a human being, I would say. Terry is a leader in the field. Terry is the author of Prison Madness, The Mental Health Crisis Behind Bars and What We Must Do About It, and is a contributing editor of Correctional Mental Health Report, and testifies often about many, many issues about mental health care in prison and the deficits therein, but particularly about the psychological effect of confinement in these kinds of supermax and segregation facilities, and we're incredibly honored to have him here.
Thank you, Sarah. I have a remarkable privilege of going into these prisons, hellholes they are, and talking to people. And I can go anywhere I want because I have a court order that I go and investigate what's going on. I started with prison law office as their expert and did a bunch of cases in California. And since then, I've been doing cases all over the country. I want to go back for a moment to the 80s. Until the 80s, I was testifying, as was Craig Haney, Stuart Grassian, and other experts for the plaintiff's attorneys. We were testifying about crowding and how crowding and the prisons were massively crowded. The prisons today have about 10 times as many people, prison population about 10 times as many people as it was in 1970. And that's a lot because of the war on drugs, because of very harsh and cruel sentencing procedures, etc. And crowding was known to cause an increase in violence, an increase in mental breakdown, an increase in suicide in the prisons. So that's what I was testifying about. They did what I call a historic wrong turn in the 80s. That is, they had this massive crowding, the violence was sky high, the prisons were out of control, and they were dismantling rehabilitation because of a conservative cry all over the country that you're coddling prisoners. And so they stopped the Pell Grants for education inside, they stopped the rehabilitation programs. There's still some, but much smaller than there were, and with the larger population, most people aren't getting any meaningful training to make it when they get out. And with that mix, what they had was uncontrollable prisons, and what they should have done is said, we've made a mistake. We should not be crowding these institutions. You know, they have like 300 people in a gymnasium. They take over the gymnasium, they put bunks in California three high, put 300 people in there, and guess what? People fight over who's going to get to the shower or who's going to get to the phone. We know that from all of the social science research. And having a bunch of people idle and crowded is going to lead to violence, and everybody was telling them that. There's no social science that contradicts that. So what they should have done is uncrowded the prisons. For instance, not send people to prison for low-level drug offenses and do something about the sentencing guidelines and such. And reinstate the rehabilitation, because you don't want people to be idle. They're not going to do well in prison, and they're not going to do well when they get out. Well, instead, they blamed the people in the prison, and they said, we're going to build these special, basically, torture chambers, solitary confinement chambers, for the worst of the worst. As Eddie was saying, I started touring these places soon after they constructed them, for instance, Pelican Bay, and I found it wasn't the worst of the worst. There were some heinous criminals in there. I met Charles Manson, etc. However, what I met also was the most political people in the prison. As Eddie said, they were reading the books and teaching people to read and write, and they stuck them in the hole for that. And I met an extraordinary number of people with serious mental illness. I, as a psychiatrist and a community psychiatrist, did not realize that we were stuffing people with mental illness into our jails and prisons at an incredible rate. There are more people in jails and prisons with serious mental illness than there are anywhere else. So we were just using them to disappear a population that we were not providing mental health care for. So they were being stuffed into the prisons. So this is what was going on in the Supermax. And this is the historic wrong turn. What started to happen was more and more isolation. The guards no longer knew how to talk to the prisoners. All they were doing was passing a food tray through. And as Eddie said, there were some nice guards, and there were some real brutal sadists. And whoever they were, they had total control over the prisoners, and the prisoners were totally isolated. There's a series of psychological consequences. Anxiety, mounting anxiety, and it keeps mounting. Paranoia. You know, the way that we avoid being paranoid is we reality test with our social connection with people. I walk into a room, I think someone's talking about me and saying something nasty. I walk over to where they are, and they say, hi, Terry, how are you? And I say, oh, I was being paranoid. And that happens, you know, several times a day or a week. I think that's the way we test reality. We have paranoid ideas, which we check out. That's called reality testing. If you're alone in a cell 24 hours a day for years, you don't have any way to do that. So paranoia, pacing, compulsive cleaning of the cell, inability to concentrate, memory problems. What a lot of prisoners tell me all over the country is they've stopped reading. You know, if you read in a cell by yourself, it's one of the ways to stay sane. But a lot of people who are very good readers stop reading, and I ask them, why is that? And they say, I don't remember what I read 3 pages ago. So loss of memory, depression, despair, suicide, these are all the symptoms that emerge in relatively healthy people. Now, the other thing that I said was that people with serious mental illness are stuffed into these units, and that's true. And it works in many different ways. First of all, people with mental illness aren't the best rule followers in the world, so they get in trouble with the prison rules. They get jumped. because there's attacks. The people are victimized or stigmatized with mental illness, so they get attacked. When there's a fight in prison, both people in the fight get thrown in the hole, so they end up in solitary confinement. They don't behave the way the guards want them to behave, so they stay there a long time. So these places are filled with people with very serious mental illness, which makes it miserable for the other people, because the ones with mental illness, for instance, the manic episode, stays up all night yelling, and that keeps everybody else up, and sleep deprivation is one of the common symptoms. There's a stunning statistic in corrections today, and that is this. Still, this solitary confinement, there's only 2 to 8% of the prison population are in solitary at a given time. Most people are in solitary sometime, but not at every moment. So 2 to 8% of the people in prison are in solitary confinement. 50% of the successful suicides in prison today happen with people who are in solitary confinement. That is a stunning proof that solitary confinement causes despair and suicide. The truth is that these places don't work. What they were designed for, supposedly the rationale, I don't think this is really what it was, but what they were, the rationale given publicly was that this would reduce the violence. The prisons were out of control, and we needed these supermax units to reduce the violence. Actually, there's been some research. Violence is not reduced by designing supermaxes, and I did an article from Mississippi where we got them to close down a supermax. And when they closed down a supermax, the conservative politician said, well, the violence rate is going to go up, and all these people are going to be in worse trouble. Well, the disciplinary tickets of the people who had been in supermax actually diminished drastically, and the violence rate in the entire Mississippi Department of Correction went down when they downsized the supermax unit. So that contradicts the idea that it reduces violence. One of the things that happens in supermax is isolation, and Eddie spoke quite eloquently about that. I'm concerned about the isolation. As I said, isolation increases emotional symptoms. What happens is that Craig Haney says that he's the psychologist, he testifies for prison office, and he did the Stanford mock prison experiment, where they put a bunch of Stanford students in the basement of the psychology department. Half of them the guards and half of them the prisoners, and I gave the guards the keys and the food. And it was a 14-day study. They had to interrupt it in 2 or 3 days because the guard Stanford students had become so sadistic and cruel towards the prisoner Stanford students that they had to stop the experiment. And what Craig says is the prerequisites for that kind of sadism and domination and cruelty is that one group has total control over another group, and the group that is dominated has no recourse. I'm always added a third element, and Craig accepts this, and that is the whole thing has to be secret. Now, let's talk about visits. One of the main ways the public knows what's going on in the prisons is contact between prisoners and their families. In California, we have a gag rule. Press cannot talk to prisoners. In order for the family to see the prisoner, the Pelican Bay happens to house predominantly Mexican-American prisoners from East LA. Pelican Bay is up at the border of Oregon. Not a whole lot of people go to visit their family, and as Eddie was saying, you sit there, you're manacled while during the visit, and there's a plexiglass wall between you and your visitor. And a lot of prisoners tell me they don't want their family to visit. Well, what happens when people are cut off from their family in that way? Then abusive practices proliferate, and nobody knows about it. So the isolation, which I believe causes a lot of the breakdown among the prisoners, is also matched with the political development, which is secrecy. There is secrecy about what's going on in the prison, so much so that I feel it's my obligation. I have a free pass to go in and talk to anybody I want. I come out and I talk about it. And that's sort of my duty to do that, because we need to know what's going on there. What we're doing as a society is disappearing disadvantaged populations who we don't have the will to take care of, for instance, people with serious mental illness, poor people. People of color, there's 50% of prisoners are African American. There's not 50% African Americans in this country. So we're disappearing people, we're disappearing problems that we don't have the will to solve as a fair and equitable society, and then we're making secret what goes on inside the prisons. And it's our duty, and that's what a lot of these legal cases are doing, to make that public and to scream about it. The other issue I just want to mention, and then I'm going to turn the chair over because we have a lot of very important speakers here, is unfairness. People who feel that they're being punished unfairly don't tolerate the punishment as well as others. We're talking about extremely harsh conditions of isolation, of crowding, of lack of activity, and anybody is going to have trouble. But people who are unfairly placed in that situation, for instance, Eddie, and I need to hear you talk about this, for being actually intelligent. Eddie was placed in solitary for being intelligent. You're not supposed to be intelligent in prison. You're not supposed to read writings that they don't approve of. You're not supposed to read and write and communicate with the outside world. If people are put in solitary because they're being human and communicating, and it's unfair, then they are going to be sort of resentful about it, and the trauma is going to be much worse. Now, I want to switch for a moment to our national security situation. I don't know if you noticed, but solitary confinement is the captivity form of choice for the enemy combatants we're capturing, for immigrants we think are a danger to society, etc. And exceptions are being made to their constitutional rights. So where the courts, for instance, in the Madrid case and other cases, have been finding that a lot of these practices are cruel and unusual punishment, what the government is saying, yes, but these people aren't covered by the Constitution, so all court decisions are moot. And now we're going to try these people, for instance, at Guantanamo within today's news. So what I'm concerned about, it's like I was first an expert on crowding in prisons. Then I, not by my own choice, became an expert on supermax isolation. Now I'm becoming an expert on Mack trucks. That is, the Constitution has a hole in it for people considered dangerous. Immigrants, terrorists, enemies, combatants, whatever it is, they are the exception to the Constitution, and that exception becomes the hole you can drive a Mack truck through. Mm-hmm. So what's happening is the Constitution is just being mooted by these current security concerns and the use of isolation, which has all the negative ramifications that I mentioned. I think I'll stop with that.
So I'm just going to turn it back to Keramet briefly. So given all that we've heard about the isolation and segregation units, an extraordinary number of people are released directly to the streets from these units. So Keramet's going to talk a little bit about that.
So I think it's easy to imagine when you hear about these places that they're so isolated that, that we as a community would never have to deal with the people coming out of these facilities, and that's not the case. In California, about 50 to 100 people a month are released directly from solitary confinement, and that isn't even counting people like Eddie, who spent time in solitary confinement, went back to general population, and then came out into society. And I say this not to make the point that these people are scary or that we shouldn't be releasing people from prison, but to make the point, one, that by definition, they're not the worst of the worst. They're not the people serving the longest sentences in prison. They're not the people who are there for murder convictions or life sentences, right? They're people whose sentences are there for relatively short times. Their sentences are expiring, and they're coming out of prison. So that's one piece. And the other important piece, I think, of this is just to realize that these facilities, even though they're incredibly isolated, Pelican Bay is on California's northern border, these people are actually coming back to our communities eventually, and so this is a public health problem, and this is a real policy problem that sort of we all need to confront. So I just wanted to read a few quotes from people who spent time in solitary confinement about what it was like for them coming out. So this is people I've talked to about their experiences. So one former prisoner who spent 3 years in solitary confinement in federal prison said, "I relive it all the time. I will smell something, and it will take me right back there. Noises, like I'll hear something, keys jangling primarily, will bring back memories of solitary confinement, like instantaneously. I would almost say it's like a daydream where everything else gets tuned out, and you actually live that right there in that moment until you realize that you're reliving it." Another former prisoner who spent 4 years in solitary confinement in Pelican Bay said, "Because you are confined in that culture for so many years, and you're functioning and operating in that little box, and you pull yourself out of that box, you are functioning and carrying yourself in a whole different world. So I literally had to retrain myself, how to speak, how to conduct myself, how to smile." And I like to stop here and remind you that these are people who are surviving on the outside, right? These people are remembering the trauma of this experience, but these are the really successful people, right? These are the people I was able to find when I asked organizations that do reentry work, that do community service, if they could put me in touch with former prisoners. So these are people who survived their solitary confinement, who made it out onto parole, and are doing really well and connected with their community organizations. And even these people are recalling the trauma of the experience years later. And one more from a prisoner who was released directly from Pelican Bay. He'd spent 5 years in the general population at Pelican Bay and 3 months in solitary confinement at Pelican Bay. And he said, Like I told you, they let me go at 11:59 at night. All right, then. I get on the bus, a Greyhound. They take you right out of prison, give you $200. They give you sweatsuits or something, and you get on the bus. The bus driver know you just getting out of prison, and he might say something. But they get you on that bus, and once you're on the bus, you're free. So I get to San Francisco when the sun's coming up, about 7 or 8, and these two girls are arguing on the bus. One was black, one was Mexican, right? And I mean, it's like, I'm not talking to nobody, I'm not really looking at nobody, I'm not making no contact with nobody, and these two girls start arguing, and I immediately start counting the black people and the Hispanic people on the bus, like I was in Pelican Bay, getting ready to match up. And I actually say, man, you know, it took me a minute to say, okay, man, I ain't there no more. Because the whole time I was there, I'm trying to, like, you know, I'm always the guy trying to say, you all got to stop killing each other because you all are black and white, and I'm that guy. Here I am now, out here, where it don't matter no more, like that man. And for some reason, it's in my head. It's in my head. So he's saying how hard it is just to imagine a different life as he's on the bus, on this long bus ride. And then I just wanted to read one more quote from a former prisoner who was in Guantanamo, just to make the point that this is in some ways a universal experience, whether these prisoners are in long-term solitary confinement in state prisons in the United States, in the federal prison system, or in Guantanamo or other prisons around the world that the United States has created. They have a real similarity in the experiences they're reporting. So this is a former prisoner from Guantanamo who was Albanian, and he's talking about what it was like once he was released, and he said, this is a colleague of mine who's interviewed Guantanamo prisoners at Berkeley Law. If people are interested, I can tell you more about her. But she interviewed this man, and he said, emotionally, another difficulty I have right now is when I talk to my children on the phone. They talk to me like a stranger. I don't have that father and children bond between them because I'm a stranger for them. They didn't hear my voice for 5 years, and in 5 years, this children's life is a long time. And I don't like going to the store. I mean, going to outside or walk around and go to places. Even on the weekends, we don't go anywhere, because when I see couples holding hands, loving and caring and having their children, and going out and visit, having a good time, it really affects us in a very negative way, because we have had a life like that. We had a normal life, falling in love with a woman and being married and having children. Now, what am I basically? I'm not a normal person. I have 3 kids who I don't have the actual bond with them. I have a wife over there. I cannot even talk to her in a loving and passionate manner on the phone because I don't even remember how to do that. I don't look at myself as a normal human being. I'm more like the animal in the zoo or something, and it's just not a real human feeling.
Thank you. We're going to turn now to Zara Bilou, who is the executive director of the Bay Area's chapter of the Council on, it's not written out here, American Islamic Relations, and has been a longtime labor activist and is now a community activist striving for better understanding and justice in the world, and is here to speak a little bit about the selective enforcement and some of the issues that have already been raised about who is going into these units. Thank you very much. Thank you
for having me. Thank you to CCR for organizing this, and to all of you for coming out to really talk about this very grim subject. I want to share just really quickly that every time I sat down to prepare for this talk, I mean, I was essentially like moved to tears just reading these stories of these people, and then hearing Eddie open the panel with his experiences was, I think, a very fitting way to start. One of the things that I hadn't included in my notes, but I think I'd like to flesh out really quickly, and then maybe we can talk about this more in the Q&A, is sort of the different terms that we're talking about. And so the first one, I think, is solitary confinement, which seems, correct me if I'm wrong because I'm not an expert in this, is a practice that is used in general prison populations. It's the oldest practice. After solitary confinement came the supermax prisons, and those were essentially like the ones you have in Colorado, the one in Arizona, the one that came in California. And individuals who were involved in the black civil rights movement, including Imam Jamil al-Amin, who was of the era of people who converted to the Nation of Islam and then converted to Sunni Islam and then were sent to prison for their political ideas, have been in these supermax prisons for years. The newer concept or facility is a communication management unit, which there's a couple of across the country, but they're still fairly new. And I think the other idea that's out there is the SAMs, the Special Administrative Measures, which individuals like Fahad Hashimi, who we'll talk about in a couple of seconds, have been subjected to. So I just wanted to put those terms out there because as I was doing the research, I was confused by them, and I think it's important to understand the different impacts that these things have. I think solitary confinement and supermax have generally been used to target political prisoners. The CMUs disproportionately house Muslim prisoners, and then the SAMs are also being used sort of under the national security banner, again, targeting Muslim prisoners. So who's in them? Political activists, environmental activists, smart people who were challenging the prison industrial complex and asking for rights, but also predominantly Muslims, right? When we look at CMUs, I think the numbers are over 60% of the population in the communication management units are Muslims. Now that sounds incredibly high, particularly when you compare it to the fact that the general population, the general prison population is only 6% Muslim. And so when you look at sort of that comparison, Muslims that are being arrested under the banner of national security are being shuffled into these units. Now what does that mean, right? Getting arrested under the banner of national security and those concerns. And so I looked up, you know, who are these Muslims that are in these prisons? And a couple of names that came up were Inam Aranutu, who was involved in an Islamic charity, Doctor of Fields of Fear, who was involved with the Iraqi charity, Hassan Alashi, who was the chair of the Holy Land Foundation, which is sort of the biggest counterterrorism. Sorry, I understand there's a party going on in the back and I'm slightly sick, so. And Hassan Alashi, who, his name comes up a lot for those that are involved in questions around Muslim civil rights and sort of the post 9/11 era war on terror. Hassan Alashi was the chair of the Holy Land Foundation, which pre 9/11 was the nation's largest Islamic charity. Immediately following 9/11, his assets and the charity were frozen. It was essentially millions of dollars, and it took them 7 years to even get a conviction. But he's sitting in a CMU, right? And then Fahd Hashmi, who I think gets a lot of attention because he's sort of one of the younger individuals that's been swept up in the war on terror. He's a young college student who was extradited from Europe because of his involvement or because of alleged material support. And what happened in Fahd's case was that he let someone stay over at his apartment. It was really that innocent. Someone slept over at his apartment and then a couple of weeks later ended up in Afghanistan with some supplies that happened to cross through Fahd's apartment. Fahd was accused of material support. Sadly enough, the man who slept at his apartment was actually also utilized to testify against Fahd. The SAMs, which I mentioned earlier, the Special Administrative Measures, are interesting because they impact individuals who are swept up in the war on terror who have not yet been convicted. So Fahd spent several years in solitary confinement while awaiting trial, right? Essentially breaking him to the point where, this was a man who many would argue was not guilty of very much and should not spend the rest of his life in prison. But the day before the trial was about to begin, he pled guilty, and many civil rights advocates have argued that it was the solitary confinement that broke him. And that was used as a measure to break him. So what do the conditions look like? Eddie really sort of highlighted this, but focusing on Fahd's conditions and what we've heard about him, we've talked about the 24-hour surveillance, that all communication is monitored and limited, absolutely no physical contact, no media or literature is allowed in many of these cases. That's not necessarily true in all cases, but in a lot of cases, it's no media or literature, particularly when they're targeting political activists and Muslim prisoners, because the idea is you don't want them to be in touch with the news or anything happening around the world, because that could be used to further radicalize them, which I'll talk about in a second. One of the things that came up with respect to Muslim prisoners is they're not allowed to pray together, and so they're being punished for trying to pray in congregation together. So they're allowed to sometimes eat with the general population, but they're not allowed to pray together. One of the other things that was interesting that came up was talking about reading out loud. And so in Fahd's case, and in the case of many of these Muslim prisoners, they're actually not allowed to read out loud. So reading out loud and talking out loud is also punishable in these cases. Again, no direct family contact, either because the facility is so far away that no one's going to make it out. Regressing back to Imam Jamil, one of the things that was done with him was that he was moved around the country from facility to facility. And by the time he ended up in Colorado, he was so far away that even his closest advocates, including his wife, had trouble getting there. And the problem was you'd spend a day getting there. You'd block out 3 days for the trip, right? A day getting there, a day to be there, and then a day to come back. But you always risked that if the guards were upset with the prisoner that you knew, or if for some reason you didn't meet some sort of bureaucratic guidelines, that you'd be turned away. And so essentially you didn't know if you'd get to see them or not. And particularly, I guess, going back to why Muslims have been targeted around this, is this concern that Muslims are being radicalized in prisons, which is interesting when we talk about sort of, or interesting to talk about this week, given Malcolm X's new biography is being released, and Malcolm X really came of age in prison, right? He went in and he came out an educated man, a self-taught man, and an activist, a civil rights activist. But the FBI, for example, has taken an interest in Muslims in prisons, and particularly now outgoing director Robert Mueller was set on the record, let me see, in 2005, he said prisons continue to be fertile ground for extremists to exploit both the prisoners' conversion to Islam while still in prison, as well as their socioeconomic status and placement in the community upon their release. And so just, you know, and that's sort of one example of a public official saying, this is why we're targeting Muslims in prisons, because we're concerned that they're converting, and then on top of that, that they're coming out radicalized. Whereas on the other hand, you look at the counter to that, and some of the advocates out of New York have said, you know, they're not being taught to hate anyone, they're just being taught to not hate themselves. Someone else said, a lot of the inmates convert to Islam or Christianity. Most people in upstate prisons are not politicized, but they can be when they see injustice and use their time to develop a political outlook, and that's exactly what's being targeted. So anyone that's raising questions about religion, that's trying to organize around religion, is being targeted in this way. And unfortunately, these days, you know, there is a disproportionate targeting of Muslims. I think the other thing that I wanted to highlight that's unique to sort of, not unique, but I think interesting from a Muslim perspective, is one of the key issues that comes up for Muslims from a civil rights perspective is modesty, right? And so that, we see that come up sort of with TSA and the body scanners, but we also see it coming up here because individuals like Fahad Hashimi and others who are being told, okay, you get that 1 hour a day, or you can go to the gym a couple of times a week, but you have to be subjected to a strip search every time you go and every time you come back, are now foregoing those rights because the humiliation is so severe. And they're saying, you know, it's not worth that 1 hour, and I'm just going to stay in my cell. But of course, that continues to aggravate circumstances. This came too late to benefit Fahad, but, you know, following Fahad's case and several other notable alleged terror cases, European countries have actually said, this is far too severe. Like, we're not extraditing people if this is what you're going to put them through. And that's sort of, and Fahad fought extradition. He preferred, as an American citizen, to actually stay in Europe because he feared the conditions in American prisons. And so I'll leave it at that. The Europeans have gotten it right. We're, of course, leap years behind.
So before introducing our final speaker, I just wanted to throw something in to add to what Zahra was saying. And as you think about the political use of solitary as a tool for repressing opposition and for just repressing people, I want you to keep in your minds the incredibly rich range of ways in which solitary is used in this country. And I just wanted to describe to you briefly some interviews that I did with 8 people who were being kept under solitary. A few months ago, I went and talked to all these people. They were in the same unit together. But they weren't really together because they were 23 hours a day in their cells, 1 hour a day out of their cells. And each of them had 1 hour a day out of the cell, alone in a room with the TV set and nothing else. And I thought of this because when you're talking, when they would turn the TV set on, if they ever turned it to a news channel, they were told, turn it away, turn it away. You're not allowed to be in touch with any current events. And some of these people had been in this unit for, I think the most was for 10 months, a really long period of time. When they exercised, they would go out alone, and every once in a while they were allowed outside to exercise. Complete and total isolation, right? 23 hours a day in their cells, 1 hour a day alone with the TV set, right? Who are these people? These were 14, 15, 16, and 17-year-olds in the San Mateo County Juvenile Hall, right? Just down the street, not down the street, just very nearby. And why were they in isolation? None of them had been convicted of any offense. They were awaiting trial, and they had all been charged as adults. The reason they were in solitary was not because they had misbehaved in the institution, not because of anything about their background or their risk factors, but because a prosecutor decided to charge them as adults. And under Prop 21, they can charge almost anyone they want as an adult. That's why they were in there. That's why they were suffering under these conditions that many European countries refused to extradite terrorists convicted terrorists to the United States or people who were charged with terrorism to face potential incarceration under those conditions. That's how widespread it is. It is everywhere. It is for every reason. So I just wanted to throw that out there as we all get emotional on this issue.
Sorry, I just wanted to add, this is on the bottom of my notes and I forgot. No, I'll project and tell me if you can't hear me. But for those of you that heard about Congressman Peter King in New York and sort of his anti-Muslim hearings, I think one of the things I want to put out on the radar when we talk about prisons and sort of the political use of the political targeting of prisoners is that, so it's a series of hearings. So he did the first one focused on American Muslims and radicalization, and for those that heard, we all know it was a CARE party. And for those that didn't, look it up and you'll understand that the CARE was specifically targeted, and many would argue, because of the civil rights work that CARE does. And this was in March. The second hearing is scheduled for early June, and he is saying that he will be focusing on the radicalization of Muslims in prisons. And my concern is that when you have an elected official sort of push the anti-Muslim agenda into the mainstream and then targeting an already vulnerable population, this time the prison population, that we may actually see abuses increase on the inside.
Thank you. Okay, so our final speaker to wrap all of this up is Nihal Zamani, who is really the person most responsible for putting this together. So thank you very much for that, Nihal. She's the Education and Outreach Associate for the Center on Constitutional Rights Government Misconduct and Racial Justice Docket, focusing on domestic advocacy, education, and outreach. She's been a human rights activist for many years with the ACLU and with... I know I saw something else with the ACLU and with International Rescue Committee. Sorry, I could have just looked to you. So she's a committed activist on these issues and a tremendous speaker, and I will turn it over to her. Thank you.
Sure, thank you. And thank you all for coming here. I'd like to kind of look more in depth at the Communications Management Units and then draw upon some of the themes that we've all brought up. So this is another instance of isolation being used in prison units. And I'll start with kind of a historical background for what the Communications Management Units are and how they started, how we heard about them here at the center, and then kind of pick up some of the things that I've heard you say, and I was like, ugh, you know, you just hear about these things and you see that these themes, these disturbing themes. So the Communications Management Units, or the CMUs, are secretive units. They're run by the Federal Bureau of Prisons, so we're talking at the federal prison level. We first heard about them at the Center for Constitutional Rights when prisoners started to write to us about them. And so we filed a federal lawsuit last April in D.C. to challenge the unconstitutional policies and practices at these units. So let's kind of take a step back and see when they started. They were established in 2006 and 2008. They were opened quietly, you know, without any opportunity for public oversight. And I think this is really interesting that we talked about this lack of political oversight. When a federal agency adopts a new rule, they have to post it publicly. And usually, sometimes, they're flooded by civil rights, civil liberties organizations that say, no, this is not okay, this is unconstitutional. And so it's very interesting. And in 2005, they proposed this rule for this new type of prison unit. And the ACLU and a number of respectable organizations flooded the Bureau of Prisons and said, no, no, this is unconstitutional. These are all a laundry list of our concerns. And they said, okay, well, we're not going to do it. We're not going to open this unit. But then they went ahead and did it in 2006, very quietly. And I think that we should kind of take a pause here. That was probably the first sign that something was amiss. And this speaks to this idea of this lack of public oversight. There was no opportunity for the public to really comment on what was being established here. And you'll see why as I continue. The CMUs are an experiment in social isolation. They have drastic and permanent restrictions on communications with prisoners that are in the units, with their loved ones, and the outside world. For example, there is a blanket ban on contact visits. So if you have an infant, you cannot hug them. And it's really interesting that, you know, when you think about your first interactions with your loved ones that are so young, a lot of it is physical, it's tactile, it's holding them. But not only that, you know, you think about what it's like for a child to be able to hug their father and not being able to. And not only is it a blanket ban on physical visits, but we have this very limited actual time that you can see your loved ones. And so up until January 2010, you only had 4 hours a month. 4 hours a month to see your loved one. And then when they caught wind of us investigating conditions and possibly finding a lawsuit, it increased to 4 hour visits per month. And these visits are live monitored. You can only speak in English, right? So because they have to be able to hear you. And what they're doing is they're actually listening at everything that you're saying in a little office in Washington, D.C. I'll go to speak to why that's happening in a little bit. You have 2 15-minute phone calls a week. So we have a client, a plaintiff in this case, who has 3 daughters and 2 sons. And can you imagine what happens when one of the daughters speaks for too long during the 15 minutes with her father because she's just won the science fair and wants to tell him what happened, and the other two don't get to speak, and they have to wait for the next time in the week that that happens. And also, at the time that they originally had him, they were, you know, not only did you have to set them up 1 week in advance, they were also at these inopportune times. So we had a plaintiff who had to drive to the school of her daughters, take her children out of class, have an emotional 15-minute phone call, which everybody's trying to remember, having a list of everything that they need to say to their loved one, being interrupted every couple of minutes. This is you're on the call with a federal prison inmate, and having that jarring experience. The girls cry, dry their tears, and go back to class. And they have to do the rest of their day like that. And this is the type of relationship that you have with your loved one. And we talked about what kind of factor this has on your rehabilitation and your ability to maintain your family. And this is so critical in your mental health and your recovery, as well as your rehabilitation overall. It's really interesting. The Bureau of Prison has standards and has talked about how important this conduct is. And I'd love to kind of draw this out during the question and answer period, yet we have these very restricted conditions. And there is no penological, you know, explanation for or justification for why you have to be isolated, why, you know, you can't touch your loved one, you have to speak through plastic glass, through a phone, and you kind of have to, you're in this tight, cramped room in the summer that's super hot, and in the winter it's super cold, and you have to kind of shuffle and pass this one phone to talk to your loved one, especially when you have these extensive strict searches before and after, and all these kind of measures in place for security purposes. So we touched upon, you know, what kind of, prison is for rehabilitation, what are these threats to that that are happening in these federal prison units. Another concern that we've raised is the fact that there's lack of adequate programming for people that will be released, and it's even more restricted and more limited. And this is what I'm going to get to in a minute, is about these particular units, is the stigma kind of that's associated with the federal prisoners that are in these units and how that carries through not only in their treatment, but the family ties that their family members are trying to keep to them. As well as the blatant lack of constitutional rights that are being upheld. And this is where we're going to go to why these units are so suspect. First of all, there's a complete lack of due process into why you're picked up from your general prison population and sent to these particular units. You get no meaningful explanation for why you've been designated, no disclosure of factual allegations. You know, there's no demonstration that you've, you know, been super violent or you need to be monitored or you're some crazy gang member and you're trying to recruit something from the outside. You get a slip of paper that might even say, you've been recruiting and radicalizing other prisoners and that's why you're sent there. No, so you can't challenge, you know, what have I recruited other people with, or, you know, how am I radicalizing other prisoners? You don't know why, you know, what evidence is being used against you, and you're just kind of sent to these units. So there is a lack of due process. There's no meaningful review, no explanation on how you're supposed to behave so you can get your way back out. And I think that then we go right to, well, who are in these units, right? So we have 65 to 72% Muslim population, which is a huge overrepresentation of the prisoner population, of the Muslims in the federal prison population. And some of them have these terrorism-related charges. And I'm going to put that in quotes because you can kind of imagine what these charges are and what they're based on. And it's this idea of material supporting terrorism. But sometimes they just are having nothing to do with terrorism. But I think what's interesting is these units were established to monitor the communications of certain prisoners in the federal prison system. That was the justification, you know. And they started sending Muslims over to these units, and the guards kind of talked a certain way about this. There was a stigma about this being like the terrorist unit. And then guess who they threw in to shake things up? The environmental activists and the animal rights activists and the folks that were organizing for their rights in prisons. So they were called quote-unquote balancers, which is really disturbing. But you start to see, you know, your constitutionally protected activities in terms of speech, being and your right to organize or grieve based on your prison conditions, you know, you start getting sent to these units. And that's really what's so suspect and so discriminatory and so retaliatory. You know, if you do this, you get sent there. And then there's all types of stigma about who is being sent to these types of units and what they mean. And so we've litigated in the last year. We put a federal lawsuit for it, and we're challenging the policies and practices and conditions at these units. We're also engaging in advocacy and education in organizing these types of events around the country to kind of draw the links of what we're seeing. And we're just seeing that this is a disturbing trend that is really reminiscent. You know, everything that you guys said, we just started to see in these particular units in various ways. And that's why it's so disturbing, and we are gaining a lot more attention. We've had a lot more media attention the last month or so. So I do urge you to look up the communications management units. National Public Radio did a great investigation, as did The Nation, and people are starting to talk about these units that no one ever really knew about, these secretive isolation units. And I do have some good news, because it's been a very, we need these victories. So last week, the government had, of course, put forth a motion to dismiss our lawsuit, and we won. You know, the court denied part of their motion, and essentially we're going to be allowed to move forward and argue our procedural due process and retaliation claims. So the ideas of, you know, why people are being sent to these units for retaliatory reasons, and arguing that there is a concern about any lack of due process and that you can't challenge or kind of review these conditions or reasons why you're being sent and not being able to leave. And so we're really pleased with this. And we also think that this indicates the judge believes that we've made some serious allegations, and now the Federal Bureau of Prisons kind of has to answer to that. I did want to flesh out one thing before we kind of wrap it up. And I did want to speak to this kind of the green scare that is happening. You might have heard of the red scare. The green scare is targeting of environmental activists, and it's targeting them under the terrorist label. So we're seeing the stretching of the terrorist label to kind of target the activities of environmental activists. And it's funny, the FBI has deemed eco-terrorists the number one domestic threat. And so, you know, we're seeing this repressive legislation in terms of, you know, intimidating and silencing the movement. We're seeing all too clear, as Zara alluded to, the targeting and isolating of the Muslim community. And we're seeing this being so reminiscent of some of the trends and disturbing things that we've highlighted before. So we want this to be a conversation opener or a restarter, if you will. And I think draw what you will from these different pockets of isolation in the prison unit systems and realize how disturbing and unconstitutional and unjust they are. And don't be afraid to be calling them what they are. So, thank you.
So we have about 20 minutes for questions. So I guess I will call on people and we'll see how it goes. You had your hand up first.
Sure. So I have a question for Dr. Cooper. I'm actually going with Craig Nini and an attorney. I'm a paralegal at Rosamund Galvin, who is co-counsel with the Prison Law Office on various cases, but one of which that I work on is the Coleman v. Now Brown case about mental health care within the prisons. And I'm going to Corcoran State Prison to the SHU. Actually, this is perfect timing. We'll be doing interviews on Thursday. And so it's sort of, you know, a big deal for me as, you know, a very young, straight out of college individual, but and very passionate about this. But you're saying to share your, it's your responsibility to share with people what you witness in these situations. And what do you say to people who, you know, that we encounter all the time who are so closed off to the idea that someone who is convicted, whether or not they committed the crime is sort of out of the question in the first place, but is convicted of a crime, you know, they have this feeling that they deserve whatever comes to them, that no matter what I tell these people, that, you know, they're not horrible people that have this reaction, it's often just people that compartmentalize, you know, sort of who deserves what kind of rights. What do you say to those people?
Well, it's a big discussion that we've all been having. The point is not how awful an individual is who did any particular crime. The point always, and this is why they're called departments of correction, is that this individual, 93% of prisoners, are going to be released. Now, what kind of people are they going to be when they're released? If we brutalize them and torture them, they're going to get out of prison and be in worse shape than when they went in. So that's my answer to that. I testified in Coleman, as did Craig Haney, about mental health care. Let me add one more point about this. I really appreciate the Center for Constitutional Law and all the groups pulling this together. There is an absolute parallel between what's been going on in United States prisons with isolation and what's going on with our military efforts, our campaign against terrorism, our campaign against the Constitution. We're undoing the Constitution in the name of fighting terrorism. And the parallels of isolation units in the federal prisons and the state prisons is just horrible. I've been asked recently to talk about torture, but part of the reason is that internationally, when someone has serious mental health problems and they're denied treatment, that's defined as torture. So I've been asked my opinion about that. I've come up with a formulation that our prisons are torturing people. I mean, I've been limiting myself to the Eighth Amendment because Sarah and the prison office attorneys say, well, it's the Eighth Amendment we're fighting. Torture is very important. And here's what torture, one of the things that torture is about, is permanent damage. When the soldiers humiliated the prisoners at Abu Ghraib, what were they trying to do? They wanted first to extract information, and second of all, they wanted to destroy their lives by humiliating them in the awful ways that they did. That's permanent damage. People with serious mental illness who spend years in an isolation unit in an American prison come out entirely broken and incapable of surviving in society. The only reason we don't know that is because in the meanwhile they've passed laws to do civil commitments at the end of the prison term. So the group of people who are being tortured and destroyed during their prison term are then being locked away in mental hospitals that they're building now to hold the survivors of these solitary confinement units. These are broken people who are going to have permanent damage. That's torture.
Start over here.
Okay, thanks. First, I just want to thank you guys a lot. This is really personally very meaningful to me. I have a friend who's in SHU unit who was actually in EdSeg for 2 months with like no contact with anybody from the moment of her arrest. And I'm not going to go into details, though I'd actually like to talk to a couple of you personally later if I can get some contact. But one of the questions I have a lot of questions, but has to do, like, the only communication, we finally have mail communication. Like, she didn't get any incoming mail for, like, 6 weeks, and finally she's getting mail, and so I have a lot of letters that we're writing back and forth, although it takes a long time as everything is read, as was, you know, mentioned. And so I'm wondering, you know, where the line is, like, you're talking about activists getting, you know, targeted and all this stuff. And this is somebody, I should say, that is in prison for something that happened a very long time ago, who has completely rehabilitated her life. She walks a very spiritual path. Everything you talked about, in terms of the conditions that she's faced in, like, you're talking about years ago, and she's talking about it in her letters today. You know, I don't want to take up too much time, but I could share a lot about this. But anyway, so I want to know, as somebody who has actually hired a lawyer for her and is trying to advocate, and they say she may be in EdSeg for her whole sentence, I mean, not in EdSeg, in SHU for her whole sentence, for various reasons that I don't go into, is things like the mail, like, are the things that, you know, like, I'm sending her, right now she can get news, it seems like the printout from the web or something, but, you know, like, can I send her this flyer? Is this going to be a bad thing if I would send her the flyer about your panel? You know, are there, like, things that are dangerous to do in terms of her safety and well-being? That's one question. I also, you know, and this is maybe more specific to her, like talk about later in person, but they are talking about her staying in Shu, like for her whole sense, and it has to do with the systemic protocol, and her situation is actually really different, so I know is there like a possibility to advocate for.
Let me try to give some quick answers to those. So in terms of sending stuff into her, ask her, because they're not allowed to. I mean, they're allowed to censor on some basic level, but she might have a better sense of what might be a problem for her if you send it in. So if she's caught with it, so just ask her. Legally, you're allowed to send in the flyers in this event, but if she has any concerns, then she's the best one to judge. The other thing I'll say is in California, in the SHU units. So there are several prisons that have SHUs, which were, as Karamet just talked about, specifically designed for this sort of sensory deprivation units. Pelican Bay.
Security housing unit.
Security housing unit, yeah, thank you. Pelican Bay, Tehachapi, Corcoran for men, Valley State Prison for women. But every prison has administrative segregation units, which are the mini prisons within prisons. And that's where Eddie was in the adjustment center, I assume. The adjustment center at San Quentin, that's what it's called. So every prison has ways of doing isolation. One of the big differences is that usually the adjustment centers are hideously noisy, as Eddie described, and the SHUs are horribly quiet. So that's one of the sort of interesting, extreme distinctions. There are three reasons people get sentenced to SHU terms in California. One is if you're a validated gang member, and we could talk forever about the horrors of that. Another is if you committed an in-prison offense and you get sentenced to a term in the SHU. So it's an in-prison prison term. And then that's a determinate term. You're out after a certain amount
sentenced
of time.
Sentenced by an administrative body.
Sentenced with no,
due internal
process.
To the prison.
About no due process, right? You certainly have no representation. And the third reason, in some ways the most disturbing, is if you are called a program failure. If you just keep messing up in their eyes. And people are in this for a variety of reasons. My guess is that that's what's going on with your friend, unless she's a validated gang member. But why don't we talk more about that afterwards, and we can talk about advocacy.
One quick follow-up thing, which is just, it's really hard to get accurate information, right, for like calling the prison that says there. And mail takes a really long time. So is there a suggestion around getting accurate information? Like I called for example, she moved from
SA. The short answer is no. There's no way of getting accurate information, but I'm happy to talk to you about attempts. Sure.
Yes, I have a question. I have a cousin that went to jail. He went back to jail because he didn't have nowhere to stay. He was living in his mama's van. His parole officer told him he could not live in his mother's house. He can only visit his mother's house Tuesday and Thursday, 2 hours a day. I mean, come on, young, you guys put him out there. No job, no income. I mean, what's going on with the system? I mean, it's to me, I look at it like they're so busy building jails instead of schools and activities for the children. This is why the teenagers are going to jail because no activities out there at all for them. They took all the after-school programs. They took all the YMCA. It's people out there with fixed incomes. They kids will never go swimming and have programs for the summer. Everything just left all of a sudden. Every time we have what you call a recession, they take from the kids. Okay, they're going to close some schools in Alameda where I live. Okay, so where are these kids going to go?
So let me just throw out a resource for people. There's an organization called CURB, Citizens United for Responsible Budget in California, that looks exactly at these issues of the robbery, taking money from social programs and putting them into prisons and jails. They're doing fantastic work. It would be terrific for you to take the energy and the outrage that you feel and get organized. I think it's curb.org, but you could Google Citizens United for Responsible CurbPrisonSpending.org. Thank you very much. And I think it would be terrific if people got involved for exactly the reasons you're saying. So thank you very much for that. There's a gentleman in the back. You've had your hand up.
Well, I'd like to ask the panel if I'm struggling with how to ask this. So with the condition of the prison, because I'm really ignorant to a lot of the stuff, that the issues that are going on, and that's one of the reasons I showed up. But with the conditions that are going on in the prison systems you guys have mentioned, and I've read a lot of things, mind control experience, I mean, just crazy stuff, chemical, just whatever. These conditions that a lot of these men and women have to live under, would the panel go so far to say it's like the prison system is the canary in the mine, so to speak, as a microcosm, as society at large, really, what we're doing, what the lady was talking about, how we really just don't care about the children, because it's apparent that we're going from schoolhouse to jailhouse with the kind of sentences that the judges just got in Pennsylvania for, you know, getting money for kids. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that's going on, and it's going unchallenged. And I came in late, and so I don't know if anyone spoke about the fact that a lot of these prisons are privately owned institutions. And I believe that when I came in, the gentleman was speaking that was in isolation, and he was speaking about the pay. And I have a friend that just got out of the penitentiary a month ago, you know, and he is a repeat offender, highly intelligent. But we know that a lot of us end up in there because of our political views, but America says there's no political prisoners in this country, right? But what I really want to hear from the panel is that what's going on, is it a real indicator of what we're seeing in society?
Well, large? It's definitely an indicator of just a lack of apathy, you know, in this type of issues in the mainstream media, period, right? Because it's the politicians always pushing out a fear factor in the community, so to build the more prisons, to provide for the corporations to make billions and billions of dollars. That's why we call the prison industrial complex a modern-day slave plantation. Right? After the abolishment of the slavery in 1850, you know, now they changed that under the 13th Amendment and turned it into a slave plantation, you know, in the modern day. So that's the difference. So the thing is, why is the solitary confinement and isolation and all these community communication management units are impacting the people who are inside, and how does it impact the society? Is the fact that many of these people, when they come out of the community, when they went in, you know, they were considered society's garbage or whatever. They need to lock away, throw away the key. But then the society expected to come out to be better people, but without providing them any type of resources or programs for them to become better people, right? But then we expect them to become better people. So this, with the sensual deprivation and all these issues that's happening with the SHU units, when they come out of society, they have no means of interaction, doesn't know how to deal with the social issues. When I came out of the penitentiary after 21 years, what do you expect me to act like? Right? A normal human being just like anybody else? Fortunately, that was the case, right? Because of the support that I have. But for many of these people, we talk about people that are coming out. There's a difference between a determinate sentence and indeterminate sentence. The determinate sentence is that if I sentence you 6 years, the max you do is 6 years unless they give you a new charge or anything you've had prison, right? So I don't care if you spend 6 years in solitary confinement with no human contact, with sensual deprivation, all of that. Your time for your parole date comes in, you're out. When you're out, then when you come out, you have no human contact for 6 years. What do you think they're going to do when they come out? Right? So there were many news that happened in the past that people came out straight from there and start attacking people, right? Because they can deal with the public. So it's the public's responsibility to understand this and to understand the propaganda, the politician and this political machine or this prison boom machine that is putting out there for the people to know that we cannot continue to accept this fear factor, you know, to appease ourselves, right? Just like the collateral damage, you know, that's what the term is, right? So the thing is, for us as citizens or our community people, that you need to get involved in this type of issue, to raise awareness, to talk about this issue, because it affects you. So if you don't, what happens is the system is setting up for the failures, for the recidivism to continue to increase, and then they are the one that who actually created public safety problems for all of us in our community.
Thank you. I was going to say, for anybody who wants just really quick information on the subject, Netflix Instant Streaming now has great documentaries. They have one on the Colorado prison solitary unit, and also on Guantanamo Bay, and it's free for just a few dollars a month if you have an instant streaming account. Also, a really tiny book called Our Prison's Obsolete. It's really thin, really easy to read, and it's all about the prison industrial complex.
Yeah, it's by Angela Davis.
Yes, by Angela Davis. But my question is, why is it that like, what is the disconnect between psychology and neuroscience and the law? Because there's all this, rules, like, you can't beat the prisons, but, I mean, it's shown that, you know, the human brain is not even finished developing until 28 years old, and, you know, the parts that are for decision-making and impulsivity that control that, and yet there's all this evidence, like, just mountains of it. Like, what's the disconnect in getting that to actually connect to the law? I don't understand.
That could take, like, a year to talk about. Can I just say a little thing, which is that every once in a while, science creeps through, which is in the Graham case. The U.S. Supreme Court just held that you can't hold juveniles for life without parole for offenses less than murder. So it's a tiny victory, but they did rely, I know. So for a certain group of people who are kids doing life without parole for low-level offenses, the Supreme Court said, no, okay, we're going to draw the line there. And they based it on the social science research and the forensic information. So every once in a while it penetrates even the U.S. Supreme Court's mind. But it's a horrible problem that a lot of us here have spent our lives trying to resolve. I don't know if there's any answer to
it. And I would add to that that human rights experts and international human rights law is not afraid to make these kind of things that we're doing. It's extremely clear.
That's why we don't let them into U.S. courts.
Well, I mean, really, you know, you have people who have studied torture, I mean, horrible, horrible instances of torture, and have studied solitary confinement, and they are not afraid to make that link really explicit. And there are people out there who've studied prisons really in depth, and they've also studied racial discrimination and religious discrimination and your freedom of expression to express your political beliefs, and they are not afraid to make that link. So, you know, we here in the U.S., sometimes we think that we're not part of the international community or we're not bound by international law. We should not be afraid to bring in human rights language. We are all humans. We all have human rights. There are very explicit links out there and very explicit connections. And so we're talking about blatant human rights violations here.
I'm so sorry. I know a lot of people have raised their hands and we only have time for maybe a few more. But you've had your hand up, I think, from the beginning.
Quick question. You guys are painting a pretty bleak picture, and it's a very tough situation. You know, things have been mentioned from court cases to activism to issues of problematizing state budgets. Where do you see optimism that something, from research too as well, where do you see optimism that something could break in? Where do you see at the margin we need to be doing more? Where would, you know, extra work be most valuable?
Well, I think the secrecy is a major problem, and I think just tonight's meeting is an example of where there's hope. A lot is going on in secret in these prisons, and the human rights community, the legal community is shining a light on it, but that's a little article on the 15th page of the newspaper. We all need to be concerned that something's happening in our name, in our society, both internationally and nationally, and we should weigh in about it. And I think that's where the hope is. In Wisconsin, that's starting to happen when it just gets over the top. And I think it's over the top in terms of criminal justice, the Patriot Act, the destruction of the Constitution. It's time for us to speak out. And I think that's where the hope is.
One more.
I think that we are missing a little bit of being at San Quentin, and Terry, you both being at San Quentin, I have a friend that I've known for 30 years that's been at San Quentin. We have to guard the guards, because the guards are the ones that are instituting the Eddie being sent to the SHU, or Eddie being sent to all the different places. They're the bullies of the schoolyard in the prison. And I think that if we start screaming as citizens of California, that the guard system stops taking our money to keep people over-incarcerated and in the SHU and in all the other different places that they are allowed to send people. They have more power than all of us together, and they're just high school educated people. And I think it's really important that we say no to the California Corrections Officers Union, if we can, because they're the ones that are putting our state in such a problem.
So thank you. Unfortunately, please keep talking to each other, and I think we'll all be around and talk a little more. But before we go, just wanted to say, I think I misspoke earlier, because Nihal was incredible in setting this panel up, but Kathleen Culhane, Where are you, Kathleen?
She's hiding.
She's hiding. Really, really did make this happen. So thank you so much, Kathleen, for all of your...